Let's cultivate our motivation. It's a very important quality to cultivate as Dharma practitioners is the mental state of contentment or satisfaction. And if we look, this is usually very opposite to our usual state of mind, in which we are dissatisfied and we want this, that, or the other thing to change. So this dissatisfaction makes our mind very unhappy. It makes us say things that are annoying to other people or hurtful, and it makes us do things that may seem rather odd to others, because we our mind becomes quite picky over this, that, and the other thing. We offer advice. We comment on everything. We have an opinion and want to change everything, or almost everything. So I think it's very helpful as an antidote to this to begin with looking at the disadvantages of this kind of discontentment, how it makes us feel, its effects on others, the karma that we create with it, and the results of that kind of karma. So to start with that, and then to gradually progress with Lama Yeshe's phrase, good enough, dear. So often we use that phrase when we're discontent with ourselves. But it's a good phrase to use when we're discontent with other people or the environment. And in that way, train our mind. You know, this is good enough. And make it kind of a mantra. Good enough, good enough. And on the basis of generating that contentment, then we have more time to spend thinking of the kindness of others, more time to generate compassion and bodhicitta, and more time to redirect our mental energy towards accumulating the merit and wisdom necessary to become a fully awakened Buddha. So with that kind of meditation, then let's share the Dharma today. So we were talking yesterday about relying on our spiritual mentor in terms of our thoughts, cultivating faith by our confidence in them, by thinking of their qualities and cultivating appreciation and gratitude and respect by thinking about their kindness. In the text, they usually say cultivating respect by thinking about their kindness. And that's always puzzled me, because I don't... how does thinking about kindness bring respect? For me, it brings gratitude and appreciation. I don't know. Does anybody have ideas about that? It's always been something that's puzzled me.
What came to my mind is, if you see a teacher over the years generate compassion for all the various different kinds of people and all of the different situations, and it's difficult to maintain that compassion sometimes, but nonetheless you still do, that to me would bring respect.
Oh yeah, okay. But to me that would be seeing their qualities of being able to maintain compassion. So, yeah. No. Yeah, but you're right. That definitely would bring a sense of respect.
I think kindness, real kindness is not connected with attachment. And so if I see the kindness of my teacher who was wanting me to lead me to awakening, that's I have real respect then if I see rather the kindness of my friend who's helping me when I have a depression or what.
But why does it lead to respect and not gratitude and appreciation? That's my question.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, think about it, everybody. And somebody comes up with something. Yeah?
My teacher, you could see he's been a monk for 40 years and he's cultivated virtues. Mm-hmm. And I have respect for those.
Yeah.
He's kind.
Yeah.
But it's those virtues that... Yeah,
that's kind of like what Venerable Jigme said, and to me that would seem more with the first one of looking at somebody's qualities, and that would generate respect. Anyway, let's go back to here, otherwise we'll spend an hour and a half talking about that. Sorry. Okay, so relying on spiritual mentors in our actions. Having contemplated how to rely on spiritual mentors through our thoughts, we now turn to relying on them through our actions. There are three principal practices. Okay? So first, we make material offerings to our spiritual mentors. Because of their qualities, kindness, and the important role they play in our lives, our mentors are potent objects with which we create karma. Okay, so that's explaining why the karma we create with our spiritual mentors is weightier or more weighty than with other people, because of their qualities, their kindness to us, and the important role they play in our lives. Okay, by making offerings, we create great merit, which we dedicate for the awakening of all sentient beings. So we use our spiritual mentors as fields with which to create merit, which we then dedicate for the welfare of all beings. Yeah. We don't say, oh, I'm creating this merit, now I'm going to keep it all for myself. Yeah. You have to give it away. Okay, from the side of spiritual mentors, the quality or quantity of offerings must not influence the diligence with which they guide disciples. In other words, the people who give you more, you don't treat better than the ones who give you less. Okay, that's clearly not going to work. Okay, and is not a quality of a good teacher. Geshe Sharawa, one of the 12th century Kadam Geshes, said that a spiritual mentor who pays attention to the offerings he or she receives is not a suitable teacher for a disciple aspiring for full awakening. Okay. Why? Yeah, well, when you pay attention to offerings, you're concerned with something of this life, and that's not a quality of a good spiritual teacher, wanting to accumulate wealth for this life's sake. So you can stack up your golden Rolex watches. I'm joking. Second, we respect and serve our mentors, offering our time and energy to assist in their various projects to benefit others. Offering service also includes tending to their personal needs, such as cooking, cleaning, running errands, and caring for them when they are ill. Okay, so if you look at most teachers, there's, you know, the students are, you wind up engaging with the students because there's a lot going on and the teacher needs help. Okay? So the students volunteer their time and their energy to help. When you volunteer your time and energy, you're putting yourself in a role where you're going to get corrected. So just be aware of it. Okay? Also, you know, when you're acting as an attendant or serving your teacher or, you know, doing a project or something, don't get the attitude of being a big shot. Yeah. Like, oh, I have personal connection with the teacher. You know, your job is offering, by offering service to the teacher, you're really offering service to sentient beings. Because who's the teacher working for? Sentient beings. Okay? So don't get a feeling of importance. Also, try and be as unassuming as possible. Don't take advantage because you have more time with the teacher because you have to, you know, cook or clean or take care of all sorts of other projects, you know, around the monastery. Don't take advantage to, tell them all your problems and ask 15,000 questions. And of course, if you have a Dharma question, it's fine to ask. But you have to be sensitive to it. It's not like you serve your teacher, you know, a meal, and while they're trying to eat their meal, then you, you know, ask 15,000 Dharma questions about emptiness or something. Okay? So you have to be sensitive and not just say, oh, I have the time. Okay, this question. And then ask all these sometimes silly questions that we sometimes do. Okay. Also, you know, if you're acting in that capacity, you may be handling offerings that the teacher receives. So you have to be extremely diligent with that, okay? Because, it's stuff that belongs to your teacher. If you stick it in a pocket and you forget that it's there and you don't use it the way the teacher wanted it to be used, or, you know, if you forget, I mean, like here, everything goes to the office. All the dana I get goes to the abbey. But, you know, you just take it, stick it in your pocket, and then you forget about it. And then sometime later you're somewhere and you find that money. And, I must have put it there, but I don't know who it belongs to. And you put it in your own wallet. Okay? So that's not so good to do. Yeah, anything that material that's given to your teacher, you should be very aware of and use properly. You know, according to the teacher's instructions. Yeah. I mean, you see with some teachers that have thousands of disciples, I mean, the attendants are like, they're so busy because they're serving tea, you know, people come and see their teachers, and so the attendants have to serve tea to the disciples. They have to clean up the cups, people bring offerings, and sometimes plates full of fruit, and then the disciples have to figure out what to do with it, and then they bring, you know, envelopes with monetary offerings, and the disciples have to keep track of that, and, you know, and there's a lot going on. It's not an easy job. And then, of course, people come, you know, when you're trying to be the attendant, come and say, well, but I want to teach her, and, you know, how come I can't, how come so-and-so got to, and you get the privilege of dealing with all that. Okay, so, you know, it's really a training in being kind and in getting out of the way yourself, because your job is to care for the teacher and help other people connect with the teacher. It's not to make yourself, you know, irreplaceable or the center of everything. Yeah. It's not an easy job. Similar to being a translator, you know, people think, oh, I'm a translator, I'll be a translator, then that's good, I get lots of time with teacher, you know, and I get this and that. And the other thing, translators are some of the people who are least appreciated, okay? You're always on call whenever somebody wants to see the teacher. They call you, so it doesn't matter you're doing your prayers, you're in your jammies, you know. So they need a translator, they call you. And you can't say no, you know, because somebody has, the teacher needs somebody to translate for them. And then when you translate for teachings, people will give a lot of dana to the teacher and very little to the translator. And sometimes the teacher doesn't share their dana with the translator. Yeah, and so the translator, you know, just put forth a lot of effort. They still have to pay for their own expenses of things, and then they don't get, people don't appreciate the translators very much. They tend to take them for granted. Yeah. Just for those who are wanting to become translators. Yeah. So as a translator, you can't have this motivation of, you know, doing it to get offerings and respect either, because you're not going to get that. Some of my friends are translators, and I really watch what they go through, and I hear from them, you know, on the side. Okay, so first we give offerings. Second, we respect and serve our mentors. Okay, third, we offer our practice. Also, under respect and serve our mentors means, like, if your teacher has a whole network of Dharma centers and they say, there's a Dharma center in Timbuktu that needs a resident teacher, go to Timbuktu. Yeah, and you say, okay. Yeah. Even though you have no idea what language they speak in Timbuktu or what the Dharma Center is like or anything, if you know, it's, that's acting in service of your teacher. However, if your teacher asks you to do something that you cannot do, okay, then you're very free to decline. If you are totally burned out and exhausted, you know, so that you can't do what you're being asked, it's fine to explain that to your teacher, okay? So it doesn't mean becoming a slave, yeah, yeah. But it means with a happy mind, offering, and when you can't, when you don't have the qualities, or you don't have the physical strength or the mental strength at that point, then you can decline, and that's fine. I had to do that once. I was in, I've done it twice, actually. No, three times. yeah, but the first time I had been in Italy, you know, those of you who know my saga in Italy, and I was totally wiped out, burnt out, exhausted. And I went to France where Lama was teaching. And at the end of the teaching there, he asked me if I would stay and be the spiritual program coordinator at the Dharma Center in France. I had zero energy to be able to do that. And I had to politely explain to my teacher, I'm sorry, I really can't. And he said, okay. And then he asked somebody else to do it. Okay. So the thing is, it's fine to explain, you know, but what you don't do is just walk out without saying anything. Okay. However, this is kind of the Tibetan way of doing things. It's very interesting in their culture. Sometimes when somebody's in a job that they don't want to be in, they often just split without telling anybody. Yeah, I've seen this happen several times. So that's part of their culture, but I think it's much better to communicate.
Yeah.
Rather than leave somebody. Yeah, so you, of course, you know, you can make your own decisions. And you know, it's fine. I mean, people are really different. And so some people, they want to be told what to do. And other people, they know what they want to do. Okay, they know what they want to study. And so it's fine. You go to your teacher and you say, I want to go here and study this or that, or I want to do this and that. And, you know, and then often your teacher just says, fine, go ahead. Yeah. Some teachers are very different. Some teachers, they want to really hold their disciples in their organization and doing things for their activities, and other teachers are more open. Yeah, if you want to go somewhere else, that's fine. So it really depends on the teacher. Depends how you ask the question, too. Yeah, so there's a lot of room in there. Okay, third, we offer our practice, meaning that we practice according to our mentor's instructions. Let me go back a little bit, too. I should also say that we're the ones who determine what kind of relationship we want to have with our teachers. Some people want to offer a service to their teachers in a personal way. Other people don't. Some people want to be told what to do. Other people know what they want to do. Yeah? Some people want to be very close. Other people don't. And that's fine, okay? People are very, very different. So we're the ones who determine how close we want to be and in what ways we want to be close. Okay, there's no prescribed formula for it. You should check, though, because some Dharma groups, there's a certain group mentality. So you have to see if there's a certain group mentality about that and then figure out how you're going to relate to it. Okay? Some groups, the mentality is you ask your teacher before you do almost anything. Okay? Other groups are, you know, that's not the case. People, you know, run their own lives in different ways. So it's, you know, you have to see what the energy in the group is. You have to see also yourself, what you want. Okay, so third, we offer our practice, meaning that we practice according to our mentor's instructions. This is the best offering, far excelling the first two, because it involves taming our mind by putting the Dharma instructions into practice. Doing this is the offering that most pleases our spiritual mentors. Okay, so don't get in a tizzy about being the one who offers the tea, you know, and not letting anybody else offer tea, because your self-cherishing mind, your self-centered mind wants to be the one who's recognized for offering tea. And instead offer your Dharma practice of subduing your self-centered mind. That is much better. Okay. Of course, the tendency is you want your teacher to notice your Dharma practice and how you've subdued your self-centered mind. You want to point it out to them so that they will know what a good disciple you are. So that's another thing to be abandoned. Yeah. I remember being in retreat one time and, you know, sitting there thinking, oh, you know, I bet my teacher has clairvoyant powers and he can see what a good job I'm doing in this retreat, what a good disciple I am. He's probably very proud of me. And then I had to crack up laughing because it was so clear that as soon as I thought that, I was not a good disciple. I was not doing a good retreat. I was completely off in ego land. Yeah. Okay. The Pali scriptures say that seven trainees, approachers and abiders, who are stream enterers, once returners, non-returners, and approachers to Arhat. So all of these who have realized impermanence, dukkha, and selflessness, and have some realization of nirvana. So these are all beings who are Arhats, fundamental vehicle Arhats. Not Arhats, Aryas, fundamental vehicle Aryas. Okay. They serve the teacher, the Buddha, with acts of love. Arhats who have eliminated all afflictions and causes for cyclic existence completely serve the teacher with acts of love. Okay. So that's a good way of serving our teacher. When addressing a group of self-indulgent and lax monastics who did not keep the precepts well or make effort in the practice, the Buddha said, even with a non-Buddhist teacher who is concerned with material things, an heir to material things, attached to material things, such haggling by his disciples would not be proper. You can imagine what the Buddha's disciples were acting like at that time if he compares them to a group of non-Buddhist disciples. So what are these non-Buddhist disciples whose behavior is not proper? What are they doing? They're saying, excuse me, if we get this, we will do it. If we don't get this, we won't do it. So what should be said when the teacher is the Tathagata who is utterly detached from material things? So what's the Tathagata supposed to say when his disciples are acting like this? Even in the case of a non-Buddhist teacher who seeks material gain with attachment, it is not suitable for students to be demanding or rebellious, following the teacher's instructions only if it pleases their self-centeredness, and not following when they don't feel like it. Needless to say, this should not be the behavior of the disciples who have an actual Tathagata as their teacher. Okay. We must recall that our teachers instruct us for our benefit, not theirs. Yeah, as much as we feel like that, our teachers should be so happy that they have us as disciples. Because we're so good. And I'm going to serve my teacher better than any of the other disciples do. Yeah? But I'll only do it if my teacher recognizes how I'm better than all the other disciples. If they don't, if I don't get enough praise, then forget it. Okay. Wanting to progress on the path, we should listen well to the teachings and put them into practice so as not to waste either our teacher's efforts or our own time. So the Buddha continues, for a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, it is proper that he conducts himself thus. Okay, so if you're a serious disciple cultivating those five qualities, this is how you conduct yourself. The Blessed One is the teacher. I am a disciple. The Blessed One knows. I do not. For a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, that dispensation is nourishing and refreshing. For a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, it is proper that he conduct himself thus. Willingly, let only my skin, sinews, and bones remain, and let the flesh and blood dry up on my body. But my energy shall not be relaxed so long as I have not attained what can be attained by human strength, human energy and human persistence. For a faithful disciple who is intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, one of two fruits may be expected. Either final knowledge here or now, or if there's a trace of clinging left, the state of a non-returner, so one lifetime away from becoming an arahant. Okay, so there the Buddha's talking about a faithful disciple, meaning, here faithful doesn't mean, oh, like this. It means somebody who really wants to accomplish the path. Yeah, who's serious about their practice, who puts the Dharma first in their life, who wants to transform their mind. Then this is the attitude that they don't have. And as we can see, some of us are not there yet. Okay, but it's helpful to read these passages, even if we aren't there, and imagine what would it feel like to be so intent on attaining liberation, yeah, that I would willingly let only my skin, sinews, and bones remain, and let the flesh and blood dry up in my body, but my energy shall not be relaxed so long as I have not attained what can be attained by human strength, human energy, and human persistence. So sit, meditate, you know, what would that feel like to have that kind of clarity about the path, that kind of understanding deep in your heart about the four truths, that kind of strong aspiration and values that are willing to ignore some of the things of this life in order to accomplish the path. So even we aren't there without that kind of disciple yet, to contemplate what it would be like is, it gets us going in that direction. Okay. And just by imagining, I mean, it's like if you can't imagine doing something, you'll never be able to do it. If you imagine it, then you're kind of taking a step towards doing it. Yeah, because the first step is to imagine it. I mean, why, as little kids, do we dress up as adults, you know, and put on our parents' clothes or put on, you know, the fireman's clothes or whatever it is? Why do we, in our imagination, do that? It's because it's a way of preparing the mind. Okay. Our spiritual mentor's kindness in teaching us and caring for us is like that of the Buddha towards his disciples. To benefit from our mentor's guidance, we should abandon all arrogance and competitiveness and be humble and receptive. With sincere aspiration to gain realizations, we should let go of all worldly distractions and focus intently on Dharma study and practice. In that way, we will gain realizations and become bodhisattvas and eventually Buddhas. Okay? So, not to be arrogant and think, well, I can explain this better than my teacher can explain it, you know. I can do this better than my teacher can, or, you know, whatever. Yeah. Okay, then our behavior towards spiritual mentors. Generating faith by reflecting on our teacher's qualities and generating gratitude and respect by reflecting on their kindness are the method to rely on our teachers mentally. As we... So in that prayer, we want to rely on the spiritual mentor, the source of all attainments of goodness, by thought and by action. Okay, so that was by thought, mentally. As we become habituated to these attitudes, they will be reflected in our actions. When we admire and trust someone, we will automatically want to live in a way that pleases him or her. In the Dharma, this means training our mind through the systematic approach of the three higher trainings, the six perfections, and Tantra. Okay? So as we develop mentally those attitudes towards our teachers, then we automatically want to change our behavior, you know, towards them. I mean, you can see you change your attitude and it changes your behavior. It's quite a natural thing. How do we change our behavior? Practicing the three higher trainings, the six perfections, and tantra. So some sadhanas, sadhanas are meditation or ritual texts, especially those of Guru Yoga, we're imagining our teacher's mind and the Buddha's mind being the same. So some of those texts say, may I do only what pleases you, meaning the spiritual master. This phrase, improperly understood, can generate misconceptions. In some cultures, pleasing someone may be a way to curry a powerful person's favor or to avoid their punishment. Witness what is going on in Washington with the testimonies in the investigation, the impeachment. You know, powerful person, you want to curry their favor or avoid their punishment. Okay? So in some, you know, in some cultures, that's what pleasing someone means, or you know, how you behave to do it. A student with such a preconception may seek to please his teacher by offering goods or service with the wish to create merit, but also with the hope to receive recognition or appreciation, or avoid getting scolded. If the teacher doesn't reciprocate with sufficient appreciation, the disciple feels offended. It is important that we understand that pleasing our guru means to transform our mind into the path. It doesn't mean, repeat, it does not mean being a people pleaser. For those of you who have people pleaser genes. Okay? There is no such thing as a people pleaser gene. Yeah? So don't think that you have to spend your life being people pleasers. Okay? Because people pleasers want to please other people, not because they care about those people, but because they care about themselves and they want to receive love and appreciation or avoid punishment or whatever, themselves. Okay? So very important to have the right motivation, because then we can do everything we're doing with a happy mind. When we don't have a Dharma motivation, we may do the same actions, but our mind is not happy because we're looking for something, you know. I want to get something out of it. So I'm doing this. Are you noticing that I'm doing it? Yeah. Please notice. Yeah. I want some appreciation. So, you know, like me meditating, thinking I'm being such a great disciple. Why was I off? Okay. So some people appear to be devoted, humble disciples in their teacher's presence, but in other situations are obnoxious and rude. I've been around those people. It's been really difficult. Okay. Because when they're with the teacher, they're so polite, so calm. Everything to the teacher, just like that. But the other disciples, oh, they mouth off. They're really rude. It's very unpleasant. So we should not be like that. Okay. Did I mention here about how many people? Well, I saw this when I lived in Italy when we had the Divoletto where our teacher lived. And guest teachers would also stay there. Everybody wanted to wash the lama's dishes. Okay. Everybody wanted that job. Get out of the way. I'm going in there and wash the dishes. Nobody wanted to wash the dishes of the participants in the course. Ordinary people like us. Wash the Lama's dishes, great merit. And we get to be near them. Wash other people's dishes? Who do you think I am, your servant? Yeah, but who does our spiritual mentor care for? All those other disciples, all those other people, of course. Why in the world are they teaching? It's not for their own benefit, it's for those people's benefit. So if you cherish your teacher, you should cherish the other disciples. Yeah, but we hadn't mastered that one. Okay, others seek to please the teacher because he is holy, but are inconsiderate to other disciples and sentient beings in general. Of course, I was never like that. I was with people who were. You know, and even when I wasn't with them, because I was not part of the in-group, when I watched what was going on with the in-group, it was too much. Yeah, I mean, the way some of the people acted. But, of course, I never did anything like that. I was always so jealous of the people who got to make tea. You know, because they got to make tea and go into Rinpoche's room when he was meditating, and there was such a good feeling in his room when he was meditating. And you got to put the tea on the table, and even he didn't say anything. You were doing something so holy. And, you know, and I wanted to do that kind of thing. But my teacher asked me to lead meditation courses instead. And I thought, you know, and this one time, because a course was going on at the retreat center, he had asked me to be the, you know, one of the leaders of the course. And he was also, at like 4 o'clock in the morning, he would invite some disciples to come and do morning meditation, puja, in his room. And that was so wonderful to do that. He had this small room. You were scrunched in there, only about five or six of you, you know. And there's your teacher, you know, you're sitting that far, and he's in samadhi, and you're kind of thinking, you're trying your best, you know. He says, experience bliss, and you're going, okay, I'm imagining experiencing bliss. You know, and then the disciple who made the tea would come in the middle and offer all of your tea, because you were the special group who got to do morning puja with him. And I couldn't do that because I was leading the morning meditation for all the people who walked up the hill who were taking the meditation course. You know, I was so stupid in those days, totally stupid. I did not realize, you know, the trust that my teacher was giving me to lead that course. I didn't realize the privilege I had to lead that course. Instead, I was so stupidly jealous of the people who got to meditate with him in the morning when I didn't. You know? Just amazing. I was so out in outer space somehow. And I remember, some of you have heard this story, part of the story before, because I was so jealous of them, and And then one night they were all going to do a puja that lasted, you know, well into the night. And I couldn't do it because I had to get up the next morning, and I knew if I went to this, that there's no way I could get up in the next morning and lead the morning meditation for these people. And I just felt, you know, because this is my teacher who doesn't sleep, you know. So, or he sleeps sitting up rather like this, you know. He's meditating. So I just felt so guilty, you know. Oh, if I only had more compassion, I would go to this practice all night and then go and lead the morning meditation to the students. If I only had more compassion, I would do that. But I am so lacking in compassion, I just can't do that. You know, because I was comparing myself to my teacher, you know. So I went into him and I felt like, oh, he's thinking, you know, what a lazy disciple. She didn't come to the practice. She's in bed, you know. So I thought, you know, I have to go and explain myself why I didn't come. And so I went. And I, you know, make my prostrations and I sit down there and I start explaining how, you know, I'm so regretful and so sorry that I didn't come to the practice last night when I was too tired. And Rinpoche goes, then? Rinpoche, I was so tired and exhausted. I'm really sorry I didn't come. Then? I will really try and be a better disciple in the future and cultivate more compassion. I'm so sorry. Then? This is how my teacher trained me. So after a few more thens, I said thank you and I left. Okay. So these behaviors, you know, being so much so holy around the teacher and obnoxious around other sentient beings, these behaviors are inappropriate. Assisting sentient beings and treating them well is one aspect of pleasing our guru because it fulfills his or her purpose of benefiting others. We should avoid becoming possessive of our teachers or jealously competing with other disciples for their attention. Nor should we use them to increase our sense of self-importance. Geshe Potowa reflected, "We present-day followers do not value the teachings at all, but only value the guru's assigning status to us, as demonstrated by each cup of tea that the guru gives us. This is a sign of our deep corruption." By the way, in addition to the picture of me and the teachers that he signed that I have, here is the cup in which he gave me many, many cups of tea, you know, when I had tea alone. Okay, following our teacher's instructions is a skill we must develop. Sometimes we are resistant to advice that does not please our self-centered thought. Sometimes. Other times we take the advice out of context, thinking that an instruction to an individual student should be generalized to everyone. It is important to differentiate general advice that is applicable to everyone and special advice meant for a specific student. Okay. If someone walking on a narrow path between two precipices is too close to the left side we call out, "Go right." But if the person is too close to the right side, we shout, "Go left." Taken out of context, these instructions seem contradictory, though they are not. To avoid confusion, we should, because both of them are trying to keep the disciple from falling off the edge of the cliff. To avoid confusion, we should inquire about the context in which an instruction was given and to whom it was given. It is important to respect and to follow the advice of the resident teacher in the place where we live, even though that teacher may not be our principal mentor. The resident teacher heads the community, and for the sake of community harmony, as well as for our spiritual benefit, we should follow her guidance, or his guidance. So we don't go in, you know, as a guest to another monastery, and they do things different than the way our teacher has us do it, and we go in and start giving instructions and correcting them, or we refuse to do what we're said because it's different than what our teacher told us. But it's just one of these things of personal preference. You know, we like, you know, we're used to getting up at 5. That monastery, they get up at 3:30. I can't get up at 3:30. You know, my teacher has us get up at 5. No, you're a guest in the monastery. You go along with it. Okay. When you, some of you who will be going to Taiwan to take the full ordination, when you're there, you follow the schedule that that everybody there does. You don't go and say, "Oh, but I'm a Westerner and I need this and that, and please give me this and that, and I need special this and that." That's not at all. It's not good. And it's not good for you, and it makes a bad feeling with the people running the ordination, such that then when more people come from other countries later, then they really are not fond of having those people. And I've heard of some monasteries who turn foreigners away. So we should make sure that we... It's when in Rome, do as the Romans do. Venerable Benyon, who gave the teachings that we made into the book on, I can never remember how we titled that book. Karmas for the Creation of Virtue, right. Yeah. And he said very clearly in that book, you know, when you go to another monastery, you follow the way things are done there. Okay. You know, if you don't understand the way they're doing things, ask questions and learn. Okay. But don't go around kind of claiming to be special or different or, you know, telling the resident teacher how they should do stuff. Okay. When we begin to give Dharma talks, we must avoid competing with our teachers, thinking, "More students come to my Dharma talks," or, "I'm a more eloquent speaker than my teacher." Also to be avoided is trying to prove to our spiritual mentors how learned and articulate we are. In all ways, we should be genuinely humble and fully aware that any Dharma we know is due to their kindness and fortitude in teaching unruly disciples like us. Sometimes we may become frustrated or angry and blame our spiritual mentor for our unhappiness. Oh, really? Really? Does that happen here? I don't think so. At these times, it is especially important to remember that our unhappiness is due to our previous destructive behavior that left karmic tendencies on our consciousness, and our anger is due to the seed of anger within ourselves. We are responsible for our emotions, so rather than blame our mentor, it is wise to look inside ourselves and apply Dharma antidotes to our afflictions. Usually, after we calm down, we will feel regret for any harsh words we spoke to our mentors or misleading statements we may have made to cover up our faults. It is wise to go to our teacher and apologize so we can start afresh. If we have difficulties in our relationship with our spiritual mentors, it could be due to relating to them in an inappropriate way in previous lives. Engaging in purification practices with a strong determination to restrain from such actions in the future will help us clear these obstacles. So I was the housemate of one nun who was helping her teacher build a new temple. And, you know, he was a traditional Tibetan teacher. She was a Western nun. And she was telling me sometimes she would just get so angry with him because he wanted to do something in a certain way or wanted the process to go a certain way. And she said that, you know, she didn't mince words and she expressed her anger to him, you know. And this teacher is one that was always just like, you know, he didn't get ruffled. And, but we were talking about it and, you know, she would go and apologize. But we were talking, she was an incredibly devoted disciple of this teacher. And despite getting angry, you know, sometimes. And we were saying, you know, rock bottom inside your heart. You know, there's a very strong relationship with this teacher. But she would apologize after she got angry. Yeah. Okay, reflection. How would you benefit from having an open and honest relationship with your spiritual mentor? So, how would you benefit? Yeah. And contemplate and make examples of specific ways to make offerings to your spiritual mentors of material goods, service, and your practice. What are appropriate ways to behave with your mentors? And what are inappropriate ways, and how can you protect against engaging in them? Okay, so again, things to contemplate in your meditation. We may encounter situations in which we hold different opinions from our teachers. We may be a vegetarian, but our teacher is not. We may think one political policy would be effective, while our teacher favors another. These are issues of personal preference. Respecting our mentor does not mean we have to agree on every issue or every way of doing things. We must remember that we came to our spiritual mentor to learn the path to awakening, not to learn cosmology or debate human rights. Okay. The Tibetan definition of human rights is very different than the Western definition. Human rights to a Tibetan means Tibetan rights. Yeah, because they're a refugee community in India. Women's rights are not included in human rights in the Tibetan community. You know, the very different understanding of human rights. But we don't go to our teachers to debate that, you know. They have their ideas, we have our ideas. We came to learn the path to awakening. Okay. And part of learning the path to awakening is learning to be tolerant of people who don't think like us. Yeah. Very important. That doesn't mean that you don't try and educate your teacher on certain things. I think, you know, if you know, you're dealing cross-culturally and your teacher is in the West, you know, educate them. If your teacher is Western and you're in the East, educate them about the culture there. that's important so that the teachers can communicate with the audience effectively. Yeah. But that's different than debating and saying your view is wrong and my view is right. Mm-hmm. Yes, when you hear, this is how people think. Mm-hmm. Okay. With one of our teachers, because the teachers in old Tibet, they just followed the scriptures. They didn't know, they didn't have universities, they didn't know science or anything like that. So one of my teachers, this is one that I really appreciate so much. I studied with him for a number of years before he passed away, and he, because in Abhidharma Kosh, Vasubandhu says that the world is flat. Yeah? And so Tibetans believe the world is flat, even though His Holiness often explains to them why he and how he has changed his mind. But Geshe La hadn't heard that, or maybe he had, but it wasn't his opinion at all. And one of the nuns, because the Abhi Dharma Kosha tells you how many pakse, that's their measurement, unit of measurement. How many pakse below Bodhgaya on the flat earth, you will find the hell realms. So she calculated that distance. And then using the globe, because trying to tell Geshe La, the world wasn't flat, it was round, here's the globe. And so she said, if Bogaya is here and you go this many pakse, down in Bogaya, you wind up in America. That's where the hell realm should be. I don't think it, she really tried to explain to him. I don't know if that convinced him. I don't think so. But, so you try to explain, but don't get stuck on it. Because think of what our teacher undergoes trying to explain the Dharma to us. We try and explain the world's round and the teacher doesn't get it. But, they're trying to explain to us how bodhicitta is the most wonderful motivation in the world. And we go, but what about taking care of myself? And what about my needs? And what about me? And I don't want to become a doormat to the world. And then they teach us bodhicitta again and again and again. One time I pulled out some notes from one of my very early Dharma courses, and I realized my teacher's saying the same thing for 20 years. Yeah, repeating the same thing, and I'm still not getting it. So if they don't understand why the world is round when we explain it once, think of what they go through saying the same thing again and again to us for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And we're still resistant. Yeah? Okay. Okay. Even the Buddha's disciples didn't always agree with him. For example, one day the Buddha said to his close disciple, Kassapa, you are getting old now. You've been wearing coarse and uncomfortable robes made of rags. Wear nicer robes offered by lay followers. Instead of eating food gathered only on alms round, accept lay followers' invitations to eat at their homes. Also, dwell in a simple residence, not in the forest. Kassapa was a very ascetic monk. And here's the Buddha, saying, you're getting old, you've done that already. Just, treat your body well. Okay? Kassapa replied that he wished to continue these ascetic practices, not only because they were conducive for his own practice, but also because future generations would follow his example and derive benefit from them. The Buddha affirmed that this was Kassapa's way of caring for the welfare and happiness of others, his way of demonstrating compassion for the world. Kassapa respectfully explained to his spiritual master, the Buddha, the reasons for not following his instructions. Seeing the virtue in Kassapa's explanation, the Buddha approved of his actions. There was no contention or resentment, only love between them. Okay? So it's fine to express your ideas, you know, to your teacher. Even if your teacher, you know, has given you other things, you can express. Then listen to what your teacher says. If they say, that's fine, or they say, not so good. Okay. Even advanced disciples may have differing views from their teachers on important issues, such as the correct view of emptiness. So your view of human rights, your view of the shape of the earth, these are not important things that we need to be clear on in order to attain an awakening. Okay? The most important thing we need to be clear on is the correct view of emptiness, the correct view of the nature of reality. Okay? And even there, some disciples have a different view than their teachers. This is the most important thing. Okay? So Lama Atisha, who, you know, all the Tibetan traditions respect Lama Atisha. Okay? Atisha's respect for his spiritual mentor, Sir Lingpa, was incomparable, but he did not follow him in every respect. Sir Lingpa espoused the Chittamatra tenets, while Atisha held the Madhyamaka view. This difference did not impinge on the closeness of their mentor-disciple relationship. So if anything, you know, you were going to disagree with your teacher on, this would be, you know, the important topic. But, you know, I'm sure Atisha and Sir Lingpa spent many hours discussing this, you know, to their mutual benefit. They didn't agree, but that did not impinge at all upon Atisha's respect and regard and veneration for Sir Lingpa. Mipham Rinpoche composed it, he's a Nyingma Lama, composed a Dharma text, and one of his disciples from Amdo wrote a critique of it. Someone questioned the disciple, how can you critique your guru's work? To which the disciple responded, if something unacceptable is said, someone has to counter it. Okay? And in the Tibetan tradition, criticizing your teacher publicly or, you know, writing a work that expressing a view that's opposite, they don't want to criticize their teachers at all. So they will find some way to say that the teacher said this, but he really meant that, you know, because that's one thing you don't do. So, but here, one of his disciples did it, okay? And the disciple was doing it in an honest way. Yeah. Similarly, even though the sutra unraveling the thought is the Buddha's teaching, Nagarjuna and other sages critiqued it, saying its meaning is interpretable, not definitive. In my own case, In my own case, I had a difference of opinion with my junior tutor, Trichang Rinpoche, concerning the practice of Shukden. I explained to him my reasons for not doing this practice and for discouraging others from doing it. Trichang Rinpoche understood, and there was no damage in our relationship. I still hold him in the highest regard, and my faith in him has not decreased at all. Even though this was a major, major point of difference that had wide-ranging effect on the Tibetan community, you know? And because Trichom Rinpoche was advocating a certain practice, you know, His Holiness said that practice is not helpful. It's not the practice of a Buddha. It's the practice of a spirit. And, you know, and it's harmful to Tibetan unity and to the Tibetan cause. And we should not do it. He explained that to Trichom Rinpoche. Trichom Rinpoche accepted it. His Holiness still has great faith in it. And life went on. But what's very interesting is people, some people who agree with Trichom Rinpoche, criticize His Holiness for having a different view, even though His Holiness explained very well to his teacher why he did that. Yeah. Okay.